Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last night, Donald Trump delivered his third annual State of the Union address on the eve of his Senate impeachment trial coming to a close with a likely acquittal. Trump started off his speech as Republicans in the audience chanted 4 more years. He did not mention his impeachment trial once. During the speech, which was about 78 minutes, he took credit for an improving economy, which has mostly benefited the wealthy and corporations. He touted charter schools by calling public schools government schools, and he continued to stoke xenophobia and fear about what he calls criminal aliens. Toward the end of the speech, he whitewashed Native genocide by saying, quote, "Our ancestors braved the unknown, tamed the wilderness, settled the Wild West," end quote. The night ended with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi ripping up her copy of his speech. In fact, when she gave him a copy of his speech, she put her hand out to shake it, and he turned around and did not shake it. So what was your reaction to last night's State of the Union address, and what will it take for Democrats to actually win the election in November? A lot of people are saying as repulsive as the speech was, it was very effective. He hit all of the points, and he gave just a lot to the majority of his base. And we'll talk about that throughout the show. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet at Your Call Radio. Joining us today is Will Bunch, national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Will is the author of two books, The Burn Identity and Tear Down This Myth. And Will joins us from Philadelphia. Hi, Will. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rose. Thanks for having me on again. I really appreciate it.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Jordan Bennett Begay. Jordan is Washington editor of Indian Country Today, and she was tweeting about the speech last night. Hi, Jordan. Thank you so much for joining us. Do we have Jordan? All right, we will reconnect with Jordan in a minute. Will, I hope we get Jordan back because I really wanted to start with her. I have to start this on a personal note because my great grandmother's tribe, a Pomo tribe in Northern California, was almost completely wiped out. They had to hide when white people came around. She actually went to an Indian boarding school, and her language was killed at that point because she was beaten for speaking it, and she never taught it to her children. And so I just really cringed when Trump said, "Our ancestors braved the unknown, they tamed the wilderness, they settled the Wild West." He talked about pilgrims many times. You know, Will, I just feel like Native history, Native genocide is so often written out of the history books anyway. But to have someone like Trump who put Andrew Jackson on his wall, it takes it to a new level.
Right. Well, you know, the word R is doing a lot of work there, right? I mean, who's R, you know? I think, you know, leadership is acknowledging that this is a country that includes indigenous people with a very rich history, and that the story of westward expansion and conquering the frontier, you know, is a lot more complicated than the books that Donald Trump read when he was in third grade in the 1950s, you know.
Well, and this is also 2020, and there's so much awakening happening. And Jordan, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay,
I'm
great. Thank you. Sorry about that. I'm not sure if you heard the beginning, and sorry to cut you off, Will, but I just got word that Jordan's with us. I have to say, you know, Native history is whitewashed. We rarely talk about Native genocide in this country, but I feel like Trump has really taken this to a new level. What was your response when he, you know, referred to the pilgrims on a pretty regular basis and talked about how the ancestors tamed the wilderness and settled the Wild West?
Oh, I was extremely surprised, and I think this speech was very the epitome of, like, settler colonialism, and especially when he mentioned pilgrims landing at Plymouth. And there is a good example because, at least today, Mashpee Wampanoag, who were the first to, you know, grief of pilgrims at Plymouth are actually fighting in court today, and that's, you know, something that many people know of, and that's just, like, again, erasure of Native peoples. You talked about taming the Wild Wild West, settling the Wild West, and, you know, we settlers moved west and forcibly removed Native people, including Navajo people, which is where I come from, and they made the Trail of Tears, too. So it's just playing to, again, his base, and he's creating this rhetoric and just erasing history, as we know it, which history books already do a pretty good job of already. But like you were saying earlier, Rose, there is a huge awakening. I mean, we have two Native women who are in Congress. We have two men in Congress. We have a handful of Native people running for Congress, and we had a record number of, you know, Native people running for public office and 2 years ago. And it's just the president, you know, the person who's in the highest position in the country is just erasing all that with his speech, too. And I found it very surprising.
Yeah, I feel like you said, so much of Native history is whitewashed or ignored, but something about him, I think he's taking it to a new level. And so you were surprised with some of the language he used.
Yes, no, I definitely was. Like, he was talking about, even just calling us in the exceptional republic ever to exist in all of human history, and he's crediting, you know, the founders, the pioneers, which were the same people who, you know, who committed genocide. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't know that the U.S. Constitution was inspired by the Haudenosaunee, the Great Wall of Peace. And he called this New World. And it's just like, you know, retelling and reinforcing the history and not telling the full truth of America.
What do you think about the reaction to this, Jordan? I mean, there's so many stories. There's so much criticism. The Washington Post came out and said there were 31, they call it, dubious claims. But I feel like what he says about, you know, settling the Wild West, it just doesn't get much attention.
Yeah, it's not getting much attention, but I think that's just a lot to what people know about it. You know, a lot of people, like a lot of America, thinks about innovation and thinks about new and thinks that is like settling the Wild West, but they don't really often think about the people who are already there before. Like, you know, take the California Gold Rush, for example. When that Gold Rush happened, they removed a lot of California natives there. And ironically, you know, the Super Bowl this past weekend, that was just a prime example of the 49ers and the Kansas City facing off. You know, you have settlers and, like, this mascot suddenly, you know, facing off on Seminole land. So that was just an excellent example of what this country is about and not wanting to know or just being, you know, choosing ignorance and wanting to not know the true history.
Right. Trump had something for everyone, and I felt like this part of the speech and other parts of the speech really were for white nationalists who support him.
He had something for everyone. You know, it was funny when you guys were just talking just now. You know, I was thinking back on those 8 years when Barack Obama was president, and you know, I mean, certainly Obama had his flaws as president, but you know, he did bring to the office that sensitivity that he was president of all Americans. And I just can't imagine the Obama White House, you know, having given a speech like that and describing the settlers in those terms without any sensitivity towards Native American peoples. Or, you know, I still remember the first time, and I think it was in the State of the Union speech, that President Obama acknowledged the Stonewall riots, you know, and, you know, if somebody who was 10 years old when that happened, you know, the idea that this struggle for gay liberation would be mentioned in the State of the Union, to me, you know, it felt like just a few years ago we were seeing progress, that this speech really could be for all Americans. And, you know, last night, and obviously it wasn't Trump's first State of the Union, but last night just felt like such a gigantic step backward, you know, in that regard, that, you know, it was a speech for his people, and his people, you know, are primarily white and very patriarchal, and that was, you know, and we can talk about some of the half-hearted bid to reach out to other groups, but that's mainly who the speech was for.
Right, and to that point, I mean, Rush Limbaugh was in the audience, and Melania Trump gave Rush Limbaugh a Medal of Freedom, and we'll talk about this later in the show, but I mean, this is a guy who has defended slavery. He has made multiple racist comments about black athletes on his show, while at the same time, it seems like the Trump administration is really trying to go after the black vote. They had so many black people in the audience that mm-hmm. they recognized, and a lot of people on Twitter, like Ibram Kendi, who's written a lot about racism, just said a lot about this on Twitter, and it's so calculated, but Will, they're so good.
The thing about the Limbaugh, it's kind of funny, you know, here you did have many African Americans who were invited guests in the audience, you know, including a woman and her daughter from my hometown here in Philadelphia to talk about school choice. And you know, many people pointed out here you had this 100-year-old Tuskegee Airman in the audience. And yet, for all that recognition, the person who gets the nation's highest honor, the one who gets a medal actually draped around his neck during the speech, is Rush Limbaugh, who, you know, has been racist, homophobic, misogynist, you name it, throughout his career. So it's kind of like, you know, yes, I'm acknowledging you other people because I want your vote, but I just want America to know here's the type of person that's first in our hearts, and it's Rush Limbaugh. And I hope many people saw that for what it was.
Right, and putting these people in the same seating area.
Right. We're all just one big happy American family, even though it was pretty obvious from so much that went on last night that nothing of the sort is happening.
Mm-hmm. And one more question, Jordan, just on Trump's talking about, you know, taming the Wild West. What response are you seeing on Twitter about this? Just there's so many. I mean, the good thing about social media is so many people are able to express their views. There's hashtag Native Twitter, for example. What are you hearing from, you know, other Native journalists, writers, people who've Native authors?
Everyone, and there's academics too. A lot of them were just seeing this is Native erasure happening right before our eyes and right before all of America to see. You know, especially with the president who, you know, just removed the White House Tribal Nations conferences. Who shrunk bear ears on National Monument. He's doing all these different things that are completely opposed and unsupportive of Native people. And they're just really disappointed in them. People are just very upset. I mean, that's just what I'm saying. I can't, it's just Native erasure and Native genocide. Like, those are the words that I've been seeing, like, on Native Twitter and social media and, like, on Facebook. A lot of people couldn't watch it. Hmm. I know they just turned it off because they just couldn't take it anymore. And just because they just couldn't watch it anymore. They couldn't support something like that, which, you know, AOC did not attend it last night either.
Right. In fact, it was, I'm just looking on this list here, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ayanna Pressley did not attend at all. And in fact, some people actually walked out. Rashida Tlaib mm-hmm. walked out. Tim Ryan walked out. Bill Pascrell walked out. Seth Moulton walked out. Will, do we know in past speeches, have politicians walked out of the speech like this?
I don't want to say that it's never happened.
Well,
but,
let's say in the last, you know, since the 80s, for example.
Yeah, I mean, it may have happened at some point, but I honestly don't remember. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of funny because I could remember because I actually just work had me look back at the story I wrote in 1999 when Bill Clinton spoke, gave the State of the Union address during his impeachment trial. And I don't remember if any Republicans walked out. I think some people did stay away. One thing I know about the Clinton stated union during impeachment versus Trump is that in 1999, Rehnquist, the Chief Justice, did not attend. And at this one, Chief Justice Roberts not only attended, but had like a nice cordial conversation with Trump as he walked down the aisle. So, but that was different. But no, the walking net, I mean, you know, Rose, I mean, we saw so many things last night that that I've never, you know, I've been seeing these things for decades, and I've never seen some of these things. Like, another thing that really stood out for me was just the chance of four more years when Trump entered the room. I mean, which made it feel like a campaign rally. I mean, look, you know, we're all used to one side of the chamber jumping up and giving standing ovations and the other side not, and that's politics, and everybody expects that, you know. But, I mean, the four more years thing, I just felt made it feel like a Trump rally to some degree, and it just seemed wrong. It really did.
Yeah, and I think that the larger question here is he's very effective. In fact, you know, according to the latest poll, he's got a 49% approval rating. Apparently, it's going up. And he's very effective with his use of police, of veterans, of talking about school choice, you know, while slamming public schools, which he calls failed government schools, talking about, you know, quote, late-term abortions. I mean, he hits every single mark. And that's very effective. And so, I mean, this is a huge question, Jordan, but a lot of people last night were saying, what is it going to take for the Democrats to beat this guy?
Oh, I've just been seeing a lot of people on Twitter saying, go out and vote. Go and vote and go organize, you know, and especially for the Native vote, too, at a critical time like this, and where there are huge Native populations in swing states, like Arizona and Wisconsin. I've just been seeing people saying, if you want to get him out of there, go vote.
What are your thoughts, Will? I mean, this is a question that so many people are asking, especially after last night.
Well, I think, you know, I mean, I think the bad news is if you're a progressive-minded person and you want Donald Trump's presidency to end next January, let's be honest, this hasn't been the greatest week, you know. You're right. I mean, this is just one poll, but he is up to 49% in one poll. That's the highest rating of his presidency. Some of that is clearly the economy, because the economy is doing sort of, you know, at least statistically, it's doing very well right now. It's not obviously doing well for everybody, but so that's happened. You know, it's interesting. I actually covered not the inside, but the crowd outside a Trump rally in Wildwood, New Jersey, which is near Philadelphia, last week. And I can tell you from firsthand experience, his supporters right now are feeling very confident. They're feeling very good about this election. That's not a commentary on their beliefs or their ideology, but that's just on their mood right now. And on the other side, Democrats, I've seen Democrats divided many times, but the last few days may have been some of the worst I've ever seen. I think this whole debacle in Iowa with the Iowa caucus really touched the nerve with Democrats, and everybody is at each other's throat, and there's very little unity within the Democratic Party now about what happens next and how to beat Trump. And so it's a very low, it's a very down moment right now if you're part of the anti-Trump faction, even though the poll after poll shows the majority of Americans do not approve of Trump, but yet it's a demoralizing time. I mean, what I would say, I said that was the bad news, because the good news is the election is still 9 months away, you know, and, you know, history isn't destiny, you know. Democrats and people who want Trump out of office can still take destiny in their own hands, and, like Jordan said, you know, they can go to work in Wisconsin and Michigan and my state, Pennsylvania, and they can do the hard work, and people can rally behind whoever it is that emerges from this Democratic process, and then Trump won't be giving the State of the Union next year if that's what happens.
Will Bunch is a national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and Jordan Bennett Begay is Washington editor of Indian Country Today. We're getting your reaction to the State of the Union address last night. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's go to Greg in Berkeley. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I just want to say, you know, the lies that come out of this guy's mouth are just, you know, appalling. But the fact that, you know, people are believing them instead of actually looking at the facts, you know, it's like, right now, they just had an article with saying that 1.2 million students are homeless. You know, the 7 million Americans are 3 or more months behind on their auto loan payments. $150 million in student loan payments are delinquent. Over 9,000 companies closed last year. It's like over 20-some a day. You know, the real numbers are what we should be looking at and not this, you know, fake economy that you trying to sell.
Right. Well, I mean, part of the problem, and we'll talk about this on Friday, is that the Nieman Lab just came out with some interesting information looking at, you know, in simplistic terms, where Republicans get their news and where Democrats get their news. And on the Republican side, you've got 75% watching Fox, 75%, Hannity 43, Limbaugh 38, and then ABC and CBS are at the bottom. Whereas on the Democratic side, you've got the numbers are really close, 70 to 61, CNN, New York Times, PBS, NPR, NBC. So it's a list of a range of sources on the Democratic side. On the conservative side, Fox, Hannity, and Limbaugh. So, you know, we're living in very different worlds with a very different set of, I don't like to say set of facts because there's one set of facts, but different sets of information. On this point, Jordan, what are your thoughts about how we should deal with this? If you have, you know, people watching Fox 75% of the time and they're telling you that the economy is doing great, whereas the data shows, I've got numbers right in front of me from a number of economists, it's doing great for mostly people at the top and corporations. But wages are still stagnant. And just like Greg said, you know, the homeless crisis is not just in big cities now. It's also hitting the suburbs.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of it is just consumers or the audience needs to be smart about, you know, looking at the facts, too. Like, question. I always say, like, question the media, question me, and or question, you know, journalists. Where are they getting this information? Because there's also a lot of worries about misinformation this year with, like, the census going on and election. It's an election year. So, I mean, consumers can just, you know, research the facts and see where if they're coming from legitimate sources, too, and not just be passive consumers about it.
And Jordan, I know we have to let you go soon. How does Indian Country Today cover the Trump administration? Because there's so much going on, especially with the EPA and the Interior Department and how it affects, you know, what is now considered or called public land, which is, you know, stolen land. But how does Indian Country Today cover this administration?
We've been covering a variety of ways. We have a Washington Bureau here, and a lot of legislation is coming through. So we cover it through that way because a lot of tribal leaders have frequently stated that, you know, they have to, Indian issues or Native issues are bipartisan. They have to work with both sides of the aisle. Because, you know, a lot of them live in red states, a lot of them live in blue states, so they have to really strategically work with them all, and even to the point, too, like, they are so afraid of the repercussions of this administration and of their own representatives that they're not even wanting to state their opinions on the impeachment trial.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's really surprising. Even though their own tribal citizens are wanting to know what their tribal leaders think and what they're doing, but tribal leaders have their eye on, you know, the real issues, you know, jobs and education and health care. So those are the ways we try to cover. We're also covering, as for, like, you know, election year, we're covering it through, like, an Indigenous lens. We're covering all the Native candidates right now who are running. We just covered the Iowa caucus, one of the only, or the only, Indigenous caucus in Iowa was with the Meskwaki tribe in Tama County. So we got those results in, but we're just waiting for the rest of the state. So we try to really just focus on the, tribal issues themselves, when we cover that administration and also all the events and, things going on Capitol Hill.
Well, we'd love to have you back, Jordan. We should do a roundtable on how this administration is really affecting Indian country. Thank you so much for your reporting, and thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
That is Jordan Bennett Bakay, Washington editor of Indian Country Today, and you can find information about her work at yourcallradio.org. Sticking with us for the rest of the hour is Will Bunch, national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And after a break, we will also be joined by Ellie Mistal, who is the nation's justice correspondent. Today, we're talking about the State of the Union address. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW San Francisco. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us. Our handle is @yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are getting reaction to last night's State of the Union address. And we're joined by Will Bunch, national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's the author of two books, The Burn Identity and Tear Down This Myth. And now I would like to welcome Ellie Mistal to the show. Ellie is the nation's justice correspondent, where he covers the courts, the criminal justice system, and politics. Hi, Ellie. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. You have a piece out today called Trump's State of the Union was a terrifying game show stunt. The president lied and handed out medals while the Democrats fumbled. And you've got a really important point in here, Ellie, and that is it was, Trump is putting on a summer blockbuster replete with CGI aliens and completely implausible plot twists. Democrats can't put on a high school play without the lead actors getting knocked off stage by an unwieldy boom mic. That says a lot there.
Yeah, I mean, look, I understand the liberal idea that we don't want to make this a show, that we understand that this is very serious, and that gamification of the entire nation is wrong. However, this is a reality TV show. His only skill is in hosting a literal game show, and he plays this entire thing with all the like tricks and japes and stunts of a kind of bizarro MC. And Democrats have to put on some counter programming, right? We have to be able. The Democratic Party has to be able to put forth an alternative show, one grounded in truth and reality and justice and fairness, but fundamentally an alternative show to the craziness, to the circus carnival barkerism that Donald Trump exposes. And when you plot last night's State of the Union, not just against the impeachment trial, but against the debacle of the Democratic Party in Iowa right now, it's just not a good look, right? It does not look like we are the party of competence, even though most people understand that Trump is out there, you know, lying and making up false promises like he's going to cure AIDS in the next year.
Right. You know, Ellie, did we call you on your cell?
Yes.
Okay, we're going to call you on your landline, and hopefully that'll be a better line.
Okay,
thank you. We'll call you right back. Sorry about that. Sorry about these phones. Sometimes the cell phones aren't very good. Why don't we take another call, and then we'll bring Ellie back. Let's go to Robert in Daly City. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'll try to make this brief. One, the first thing to attack would have been that the prescription drug prices have not, in fact, gone down. The increase was slightly, it was less than it has increased over the years. There's several different ways to look at it. And very simply, you can puncture a hole in it by saying that drug prices went up this year. They were increased 3.5 or 3.8%. All right. And with how to address the issue in the election, I have no idea why, but the Democrats refuse to address his issues in a very simple way. He brought someone from Afghanistan as a show. We know that, in order to say, look what I did. I brought this man home. Everybody be proud. But all they had to do was point out, gee, so your promise of bringing everyone home turned out to be one person? Mm. And that's your speech? What happened to the rest of that? Why is this one get selected and all the others get abandoned? Very simple. Very simple.
I mean, yeah, well...
They won't do it. Well, they're afraid. If we attack that, we're going to get in trouble.
Right.
So they put their head in the sand and said, I'm not going to address that. I heard you, Rose. You even gasped. You said, oh, yeah, that's the point.
Well, and what about this? Because the Republicans for so long... I mean, let's just be blunt about this. When it comes to veterans' bills, to ensure that they have health care, to ensure that they have what they need, they mostly vote against it. And yet they use veterans as props. This has been happening since the Bush administration. I mean, we've done shows about suicide, about homelessness. They never prepared for what was going to happen when all of these people came home with missing limbs, with, you know, brain injuries. The list is so long, and it just continues.
Everything that Trump uses is a prop, right? Like, he pulled out last night a 100-year-old Tuskegee Airman and gave him a field promotion, right? Like, does that do anything to help the causes of racial equality and social justice? No, of course not. But hey, look at this black guy that I pulled up. As I said in the Nation piece, remember, this is the same reality TV show host that created Omarosa. So these are all his tricks to put on this kind of ridiculous, bizarro show, and it had no policy. I think people forget that what State of the Unions used to sound like were the President of the United States laying out a legislative agenda for the country for the next year. Trump had almost no legislative proposals. Had no grand vision of the country. It was all just hucksterism.
Well, yeah, and go ahead, Will.
Can I just add also, not only were these stunts, and not only was there not usually any policy behind them, but, you know, so often they were stunts that just belied the actual reality of what's happening. Near the end, there was that scene that everybody... You know, in the morning TV show, they're all calling the most touching moment when that soldier came home from serving overseas and was reunited with his family. And, you know, the reality is, I mean, Trump ran on a platform that he was going to end the forever wars, that he was sick of this and he was going to bring troops home. And the reality is there's more troops fighting now overseas than there were when Trump became president. And so, like, you know, bringing one home and making a stunt out of it on national TV isn't the reality of what's happening with President Trump, you know, and it's just frustrating. It just makes you want to pull your hair out sometimes. It really does.
Well, right. And again, we'll continue to do shows about this, but what about all of these veterans who cannot get health care and are going to have, you know, PTSD, brain injury? I mean, I got an email from one of our listeners, and she said, my son was over there. He's going to have problems for the rest of his life. And the government has not taken steps to ensure that he will have the care that he needs for the rest of his life. So that's just one issue that came up last night. Thank you for that call. Let's go to Nancy in Berkeley. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. You know, I listen to all this, and I'm a very liberal sort of Democrat, and my feeling is that nothing can stop Trump. I really love Elizabeth Warren, and I like Bernie Sanders. None of them are going to be able to beat Trump.
Ellie, would you respond?
I couldn't really hear her questions of what.
She basically said, "I don't think anyone can stop Trump. The Democrats, like you said, they're just making all these mistakes. They're now changing the rules so Bloomberg can debate because he has endless amounts of cash." She says she doesn't think anyone can beat him.
Okay, so where I disagree with that is anybody can beat him. The polls suggest that literally all of the top serious Democratic candidates are beating him. In head-to-head matchups, right? We can never forget that Trump is only in power because he has convinced a minority of the country to go along with his grievance politics. And that minority is overrepresented in the Electoral College. But even with that inherent advantage, Trump only won, you know, we only need to change about 80,000 votes across three different states to defeat him if we have similar turnout levels to 2016, to say nothing of the massive turnout that we had in 2018. So while, yes, it is important to understand that Trump is a Goliath, he is strong. I have pointed out that we have to remember no incumbent president has lost a reelection campaign since 1992. That's a generation ago when George H.W. Bush lost to Bill Clinton. So he has inherent advantages that will be hard to overcome, but he is not unstoppable. The majority of the country is against him, and if we just if we come together and marshal our resources and do things smartly, absolutely he can be defeated.
Will, what are your thoughts? And let me just say, to Nancy's last line, we do not condone violence, just to put that on the record, because I just want to put that out there. Will, what's your response?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You know, I think your caller, other than that last line, I think was pretty representative of the Democratic electorate right now, which is I'm seeing this again and again, that people are gripped by fear. You know, people are very afraid. I mean, they're afraid of Trump winning another term, but they're also afraid that if they don't somehow handle this nomination process perfectly, whatever that means, you know, that that's going to hand the election to Trump, and that they have to have the perfect candidate, and none of the candidates seem perfect. And, you know, I'm just hoping the Democratic electorate is going to get over that, you know, get over that feeling. Because I do think, I mean, look, you know, Iowa was a debacle, and hopefully, you know, by this time next week, we'll have forgotten about Iowa. But I was only one of the first of, there's 49 more states. And, you know, hopefully as this primary process emerges, no matter who ends up getting the nomination, whether it's Bernie or whether it's Buttigieg, I mean, two people who have very different politics on some level, but whoever wins will win because they excited the electorate, you know, and if they have a good convention in Milwaukee and if they can rally the party behind them, then like Ellie said, I mean, already, even at this phase, when Democrats are so depressed, the polls show that almost all their candidates beating Trump in most places, you know, and there's nowhere to go but up, I think, in that regard. I think Democrats need to let the process play out, but I think they need to keep in mindful that, you know, the best way to win is with enthusiasm and with a lack of fear.
And can I also add to Will's point, like, we also have to remember that part of the authoritarian game is to make us hopeless. It is to make us depressed. It is to make us give up on our institutions and give up on our belief that anything can be done. It is how they keep us docile, by taking away first our hope. And that is the thing that we cannot give them, right? We have to hold on that there is some hope that he can be defeated, or else he has already done, he has already rented out space in our brain that he does not deserve.
Hmm. That is Ellie Mistal. He is the nation's justice correspondent covering the courts, criminal justice, and politics. You can find his writing at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Will Bunch, national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And if you'd like to join us, we're talking about last night's State of the Union and where we go from here. I mean, I think Ellie just made a great point about not falling into that trap, just saying he's going to win again. What are your thoughts? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We have an email from Sharon who says, Trump and the Senate majority tout that there's less welfare and SNAP food stamps allotted in the budget in the face of facts that 11% of citizens are food insecure, 35 million plus. Brag about cutting back funds for the National School Lunch Program. cutting funds for WIC. This is for women, infants, and children. This is corporate fascism. Yeah, I mean, what about that one, Will? You know, there's so much to unpack there when you talk about food stamps and the school lunch program.
Right. That was a classic case of you know, he's tightened eligibility for food stamps, right? So he's made it more restrictive and fewer people are qualifying to take part in the program. Mm-hmm. And then he's bragging about how good the economy is because fewer people are on food stamps. It's absurd, you know. I mean, the reality is the problem isn't how many people are on food stamps. The problem is food insecurity, formerly known as hunger, right?
Right.
And the truth is, if you're kicking people who suffer from food insecurity off their food stamps, that doesn't mean that you've solved the problem. You've only made the problem worse. And you know, that's the type of thing. And you know, and I mean, there was fact checking, and people were fact checking the speech, and as egregious as that lie was, it probably wasn't the most egregious of a number of lies that Trump told in that speech. But you know, it's very frustrating, you know, you know, getting back to what we've been talking about and what Ellie was talking about, the reality show aspects of his performance distract us from these basic untruths when it comes to policy.
Right, and we covered this in December. 700,000 people were set to lose their food stamps under Trump's new policy. Ellie, what would you add?
That moment was the most offensive part of the speech for me.
Yeah.
Not because of the depth of Trump's lies, because as Will pointed out, there were actually bigger whoppers that he told, but because that was his loudest applause line. That is when the entire Republican caucus got up and started cheering and hooting and hollering like they just won a football game. And what were they cheering for? Kicking hungry people off of assistance. That is the Republican Party today. A group of people who thinks it is great that more people are going hungry in our country.
Yeah.
And if you cannot draw the kind of straight line between what Trump said and how the Republicans cheered for that, and how it's not just Trump that has to be voted out of office, but all of these complicit Republican senators and congresspeople who enable this kind of cruelty, then I don't have anything for you. Like that was the clearest line of the night that shows the moral bankruptcy that the Republicans have come to.
That was pretty striking. And Ellie, when Nancy Pelosi ripped up the speech, that was when I thought, wow, so much of what should be focused on is going to go toward her ripping up the speech.
See, I actually love that part. And I'll tell you, and I totally do agree with you that it shifted the focus, but I kind of liked it as a moment for two reasons. One, as a moment of political theater. I'm the one saying we need to be at least a little bit performative. That was clearly performative. Nancy Pelosi did not lose her cool. That woman is incapable of losing cool. She did it on purpose. She knew the cameras were still on her when she did it. That was her Democratic response to Trump's State of the Union, and it was completely strategic. Now, what's the strategy there? Well, if you look at Republican Twitter and Republican commentators, all they're doing today is screaming about Nancy Pelosi ripping up the speech.
Right.
The story that you should want out of the State of the Union is, oh, look at this great economy, and look at our strong, masculine president. And they can't, because they're all just like, oh, yeah, she ripped that speech. Oh my gosh, she's classless! Like, I think that was part of the strategy. It was to bait and troll Republicans to step on their own story, and they are obliging.
Right, and for those who did not watch, the beginning of the night started out with Trump giving Mike Pence a copy and Nancy Pelosi a copy, and when she put her hand out to shake his, he just turned around and didn't put his hand out. One more quote or fact about the economy. According to the Washington Post, people in the bottom half have essentially no wealth, just 1.6% of the nation's wealth. And then the top 5% hold more than 70% of all net worth in the U.S. Also, Trump did not talk about his tax cuts last night for the incredibly wealthy. And Will, the facts show that this is actually going to hurt people in the middle and the lower, and it's a boon for people who are ultra wealthy and a boon for corporations.
Right. Well, he really tried to portray himself in this speech as the president for America's, you know, forgotten middle class. And the evidence of anything he's done for the middle class just isn't there. I mean, you know, we just saw a new report this week that the manufacturing economy in this country is the most sluggish that it's been in the last 10 years, which is kind of funny because 10 years ago was the end of the Obama administration, or, I mean, was before the start of the Obama administration, I meant to say. So, you know, I mean, he promised factory workers that he was going to bring their jobs back. And, I mean, clearly he failed in that regard. Like you said, the tax cut was, that's his biggest legislative achievement, and yet it doesn't even get mentioned because people are smart, people have wised up now to the fact that it did nothing for them if they're an average, if they're an average working person. So, yeah, I mean, just so many examples, Rose, of hypocrisy there.
Right. That is Will Bunch, national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News, and Ellie Mistal is a columnist with The Nation. He's their justice correspondent covering the courts and criminal justice. We've got another email from a listener. How can Democrats hold on to hope for the 2020 election when that election will be vulnerable to tampering? There are many angles to this, Ellie. We've done a lot of shows about voting machines. We've had so many, you know, scientists on who say we need to go back to paper, and then you see what happens in Iowa. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, this is why Iowa hurts so much, because it plays into all of these fears and all of these conspiracy theories and all of our, you know, big honking election insecurity that we've known about for a while but done nothing to redress. I think the emailer is exactly right. Certainly, as just a citizen watching Iowa, I'm like, oh no, this is the problem, people. What's the hopeful response to that? Overwhelming turnout. It cannot be a close election. If it's a close election, he's going to stay. If it's a close election, it would require the military to remove him. So it's got to be overwhelming turnout. It's got to be an overwhelming rebuke of him and his administration and his party and his enablers. That's the only, you can't secure our elections against hacking, because the people in charge of securing those elections kind of want the hacking to happen, right? It's the Russia if you're listening problem. So the only way to overcome that is overwhelming turnout and an overwhelming rebuke of this administration. People have to be willing to stand in line. People have to be willing to learn their rights. People have to commit to bringing friends and families to the polls. That's the only way.
What would you add, Will?
I wouldn't add much. I mean, I had the same thought. I mean, Iowa was bad on two levels. It was bad because it made the Democratic Party look inept and incompetent, which was not good. But I think Ellie was right. I think it also played into this terror people have that our elections are no longer secure, and it seems like the situation is getting worse. I mean, the things that happened in 2016 were bad enough, and you know, to have this election, and you have all the TV pundits are on TV, and the anchors, and they're ready to broadcast all night, and there's zero results coming in. It was just like everybody's worst fear that they saw played out in front of them. And, you know, I think Ellie's right. I think I hopefully it will not be a close election.
Will Bunch is national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer and author of The Burn Identity and Tear Down This Myth. Will, thank you so much for joining us.
Rose, thanks again for having me. I really appreciate it.
And Ellie Mistal is the nation's justice correspondent, where he covers the courts, the criminal justice system, and politics. Ellie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Sorry about the connection issues.
No, it's fine. Thank you. And I just wanted to note, we did not have time to talk about this, but the father of a high school freshman killed in the 2018 mass shooting at Parkland's Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School was removed from the audience last night after shouting when Trump talked about support for the Second Amendment. For those of you who may have seen, Nancy Pelosi was looking up, and we didn't really know what was going on until after. So if you hadn't read any of the follow-ups, I just wanted to give this information out. Fred Guttenberg, whose 14-year-old daughter, Jamie, was killed in the February 14th, 2018 shooting. And he was escorted out of the balcony gallery of the House chamber. He is a prominent gun safety activist. He was invited by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. We still don't know exactly what he said, but he has been tweeting this morning and he actually apologized for his outburst. But how can you blame a guy like this when Trump and the entire Republican Party were standing up clapping for guns and the Second Amendment? And so I just wanted to share that story about Fred Guttenberg. You can find more information about the writings of Will Bunch and our other guest, Ellie Mistal, at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show and Joanne Marr, our studio engineer. Tomorrow, we will be talking about missing and murdered Indigenous women. So I hope you can join us for that. Thanks for joining us. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar.